This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 175.
I think number one is that we assume managing up is something we do for our boss. And that's often how it's been described to us. Most of us have been told, well, you need to manage up, keep your boss happy, know what their priorities are, make them look good, right? It's very them-centered. And I want to flip that on its head because managing up is something you do to get the clarity, the autonomy that you need in your role. And so, yes, it is a wonderful side benefit that you build more trust with your manager, that you can build relationships with other leaders throughout the organization. But like you were saying, ultimately, it's for you to feel more on top of and control of your calendar, your inbox, the work that you are doing, instead of just feeling like you are a subordinate, you become more of a trusted partner to the people in charge. So you feel more agency in your career when you know you have tools and tactics to make sure that your opinion is heard, that your voice is a valued one at the table, that your manager comes to you for recommendations and input, that you're not just executing the demands that come down from on high.
How can managing up help you to have more impact and influence? Why is managing up a critical leadership skill for all HR leaders? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Most HR teams are executing better than ever, and yet many CHROs are wrestling with the same question. Are we truly creating enterprise value or just delivering excellent support? After interviewing more than 150 CHROs and senior HR leaders, one thing is clear: execution excellence is now table stakes. And while execution earns trust, value creation is what differentiates the best HR teams. That insight led me to create my keynote presentation, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow. This isn't a motivational talk, it's a practical roadmap for helping HR leaders move beyond execution and step into a new standard of leadership, evolving from business partners to true value creators. I've delivered this keynote for HR teams at companies like AbbVie, Nike, Corning, Kohler, and LabCorp. And if you're planning an HR conference or leadership event and want your team to leave thinking and operating at a higher level, visit futureofhr.com to get in touch. Let's design a keynote that meets the moment HR is in right now and helps your team show up differently because of it. And with that, my guest this week is Melody Wilding. Melody is a best-selling author of Trust Yourself, Stop Overthinking, and Channel Your Emotions for Success at Work, and her latest best-selling book, Managing Up, How to Get What You Need from the People in Charge. For more than a decade, Melody's helped top performers and leadership at the world's most successful companies, including Google, JP Morgan, and Verizon, to communicate more clearly, prevent burnout, and transform complicated workplace dynamics into powerful alliances that impact the bottom line. And Melanie's got a unique background. She's a licensed social worker with a master's degree from Columbia University. She's a professor of human behavior at Hunter College in New York City. And she's a former emotions researcher at Rutgers University, which really gives Melody a unique perspective on how to manage up, have more influence and impact. And in my conversation with Melody, we're going to dive deep into her book, Managing Up. And I'm going to present Melody with real life situations that I know you and other HR leaders are facing. And each of these situations, I'm going to ask her to coach us and give us some tools and frameworks that we can use to solve these challenges for not only the leaders we support, but even for ourselves. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode, so please feel free to drop me a line on LinkedIn. And with that, let's get into my conversation with Melody. Melody, welcome to Future of HR Podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining. I'm really excited to talk to you. Really love the book. Enjoy reading it and getting prepped for this conversation. And I'm curious, what made you decide to write Managing Up, how to get what you need from the people in charge?
Well, this idea really came about from feedback from my audience. Shortly after the pandemic, really in the midst of the pandemic, I would say around 2022, what I was hearing from people who follow me, my readers of my first book as well, was this consistent feeling of being out of control at work, that everything was changing so quickly. There was a reorg every 6 months, if not 3 months, for example, that priorities were shifting so quickly. And people just felt like they were being jerked around by the whims around them. They weren't in the driver's seat of their career anymore. That's when this idea of really being more assertive about what you need, getting what you want from the people in charge, came about.
Oh, that's brilliant. And I think a lot of people do feel that way and struggle with, like, well, how do I regain control? How do I better manage my boss, better manage my peers, better manage my calendar, inbox? All those things are hitting the same time. But you argue that managing up is a leadership skill, which I 100% agree with. But what's the biggest misconception leaders have about managing their own boss?
I think number one is that we assume managing up is something we do for our boss. And that's often how it's been described to us. Most of us have been told, well, you need to manage up, keep your boss happy, know what their priorities are, make them look good, right? It's very them-centered. And I want to flip that on its head, because managing up is something you do to get the clarity, the autonomy that you need in your role. And so, yes, it is a wonderful side benefit that you build more trust with your manager, that you can build relationships with other leaders throughout the organization. But like you were saying, ultimately, it's for you to feel more on top of, in control of your calendar, your inbox, the work that you are doing, instead of just feeling like you are a subordinate. You become more of a trusted partner to the people in charge. So you feel more agency in your career when you know you have tools and tactics to make sure that your opinion is heard, that your voice is a valued one at the table, that your manager comes to you for recommendations and input, that you're not just executing the demands that come down from on high.
Yeah, and I love that reframe. And I think the more that you're managing up in that way, where you're managing yourself, but you're managing the situation more proactively, you show up more like an executive, more like a leader, more like you are proactive and taking charge, which I think just shifts the dynamic a lot of times in those relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. You are projecting leadership qualities by the way you are showing up to the relationship. Most of us, again, because we grow up with certain understandings of power dynamics, you should be deferential to those who are in authority. When leaders today, they want people who are coming to the table with ideas, who are taking ownership. All of us are under so much cognitive burden of all the information coming at us. So yes, the more you can approach your manager and say, this is the direction I think we should go. I've evaluated X, Y, and Z, and here's why I think this is the best approach. What do you think? One of the best things you can do when it comes to managing up is save the people around you cognitive bandwidth. They will love you for that, because there's just a deluge coming at us at all times.
I love that. Yeah, I think that cognitive bandwidth or overload is so true. And the more we can be clear and have clarity around what we're doing, what we need, can help everybody. All right, Melody, this is the fun part. What I thought we'd do is you be the coach to HR leaders. So I'm going to give you situations that I think HR leaders have had, or I have had as an HR leader, and then I want to hear how you would respond. You game for that?
I love it. Let's go.
All right. So the first coaching opportunity here, if a leader tells HR, comes to HR, my manager is inconsistent, I never know what they want, what practical tools would you give HR to help that leader get clarity?
There's a few. I would start with what in the book I call the alignment conversation. This is the first chapter in the book for a very good reason, because it's the most fundamental, yet we tend to overlook it as well, because we're all heads down, just getting through our task list every day, just doing what we need to do. We rarely pick our heads up and reevaluate, what am I supposed to be focusing on? What is the highest value work now? Leaders, for their part, they may have the best intentions, but they are so busy. Sometimes they are forgetful. They're human too. They may not be trickling down information as priorities change, that then the employee is perceiving that as inconsistent, or this person keeps changing directions when in fact things have been evolving, but that leader is unfortunately not proactively communicating that. And so I would be telling this HR leader to train your people on having the alignment conversation. This is you and I are recording this towards the end of the year. This is a great time to be doing that, looking for any sort of natural transition point or natural segue to bring it up. So as we're coming towards the end of the year, I'm looking ahead to the next year and thinking about how can I set myself and my team up for success? I'd like to set aside 20, 30 minutes to talk with you, boss, about what's top of mind and what does success look like in the year ahead. That's the best way you can frame it. And again, if it's not end of year, maybe it's the end or a beginning of a quarter, maybe it's the start of a new project, or you're onboarding some big customer. Just looking for a reason to have this can be a really great way to bring it up. But when you're having that conversation, coaching people on better questions to ask besides, what are your top priorities? Because many times leaders are asked that to the point where they just give a very trite answer that doesn't add a lot of depth. When I've spoken about this topic to companies, some of the questions that people are like, oh, that's a great one. And that really was a needle mover for me and my boss. One of those is, what are the metrics you and your manager speak about? That provides almost instant clarity into what is your manager being evaluated on? Therefore, what are they more likely to care about and put attention towards? What is your skip level or even higher level leadership? What is their attention? Because resources are probably going to go in that direction. There's going to be maybe more scrutiny on those projects as well. And so that helps you understand, am I working on the highest value things? Do I need to make a bit of a pivot to understand maybe I want to transition to a project that's a bit more revenue generating as well? So that question of what are the metrics you and your manager speak about is a great one. One more I'll say right now is, what are the challenges or issues on the team that keep you up at night or that you find yourself thinking about the most? That's an excellent way to get past the facade of, oh, what are your top priorities, right? We all give a very sanitized answer to that. But if you say, what keeps you up at night? What really is concerning you when you look ahead to the next year? That's going to surface some of the important, but maybe not necessarily urgent things that are coming up, gaps that you can help fill, again, to become that trusted advisor or partner to your leader versus just the executor.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's so helpful to just get past the baseline of like, what are your big priorities? Maybe go a little bit deeper, Melody, in terms of, okay, so let's say we've gotten to a better answer where what's keeping them up at night, what the metrics they're looking at, maybe a leader's been much more transparent about, hey, these are the four things I've got to deliver, or the function has to deliver, and then this is what you're responsible for. How do you stay aligned? Like, how do you stay and finish that conversation in a right way so we're not pandering? Like, well, how would you like me to keep you informed and keep you updated? You know, how do you bring that conversation up? Because I think that's the second part of alignment, is that we talked about it, but now did you execute it and do it?
100%. I appreciate you saying that, because even though the book is framed around these 10 conversations to manage up, they are not one and done conversations. These are conversations you're having over and over again. They are evolving dialogue. So I think that is so important that you have to keep this thread open. You're touching on something that most people miss when it comes to any type of managing of conversation they have with their boss, is they leave out that last step of contracting and creating accountability. Because getting agreement in a conversation is very different than creating accountability. You might say, good talk, glad we're on the same page. That's agreement, but that's not, what are we going to do about this? What is happening next? And when, what does that look like? And so having that contracting portion to say, this is great. As a result, I hear this project is important. So if you're open to it, I'm going to connect with this stakeholder to make sure that I'm briefed on this and can get up to speed. And if we can, what I would like to do is put 30 minutes on the calendar now, next month, to have a touch base, a pulse, to make sure we're both on the same page about this and make sure that this is still the key priority. So that contracting piece is huge. And again, that's a part of you exhibiting and having more agency in your relationship with your leader. Because most people will say, oh, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you for carving this out. I know you're so busy, versus coming to the table and saying, okay, I am a driver in this now, and I'm going to be the one to close the loops and not just wait for my manager to do that for me, because this is the clarity I need and want in my role.
Yeah. And I love that from all agreement to accountability is a really big shift. So ever should underline that piece. And what I also say, as have been an HR executive, I'm going to appreciate that my team did that. And so will your VP or SVP, whoever you're working with, they're going to appreciate the fact that you said, hey, that is awesome. We're aligned. I want to come back in a month. I'm going to set up 30 minutes to follow up on this with you. Here's the next steps. Does that work for you? And what that does is like, oh, great. I'm not worrying about it. Like, I know there's going to be accountability. It's going to be executed. It wasn't just a great conversation where we got alignment, but I don't know what's happening next. So I think that contracting, that follow-up is also really, really critical to show you're taking the next step. All right. Next one is a leader constantly says yes to everything their boss asks for and is unfortunately then kind of burning out, right? They're just answering emails all hours of the night, all text messages, all kinds of crazy requests. How should HR coach this leader to set boundaries without damaging the relationship or their reputation with their manager?
I love that you brought this up as a scenario, because you and I were chatting before we hit record here about how one of the number one things I'm brought into organizations for is exactly this, is the C-suite saying, our people are not pushing back. They're not saying no. And as a result, we're facing really bad consequences as a result. Deadlines are falling through. Our customers are unhappy. And for the employee, that can be so counterintuitive, because there has been a cultural message of volunteer, step up. That's how you get ahead. Be a team player. HR, it's partly contingent on HR to say, we need you to push back, to normalize that that is okay. And that is a necessary leadership skill, being able to negotiate deadlines and actually manage your workload. That's what we need to see from our highest performers. So first is, again, is coaching people, giving them that reframe. And then in terms of tactics, there's a couple from the book that personally I use all the time. I know are very successful for clients and readers as well. The first one of those is the trade-off approach. And this is getting into that negotiation aspect, where instead of just saying, yes, sure, happy to take that on, and just thinking your plate can continue expanding and expanding and expanding. Or the other thing that typically happens is people go the complete other direction and they snap when they're given one more thing. They bite back at their manager and say, are you serious? You just gave me this and that, and we can't do all of this, and we need more people. And that doesn't look good either. With the trade-off approach, you're coming at it with more of a problem-solving perspective. You're coming to the table and saying, okay, I hear this is important. We had previously talked about how this other thing was a priority. I'm happy to make time for this new thing. As a result, what would you like to deprioritize or temporarily slow down on? Or in order to make space for that, I'll need to delegate this to that other team. Are you okay with that? And again, this is showing you understand the bigger picture. You understand the difference between urgent versus important. You can frame that as asking a question to say, which would you prefer here? Or, and this would be my recommendation, is to come to the table with a clear proposal to say, all right, based on what I'm hearing, this current action aligns more with what we're trying to achieve. And so what the team will do is we'll move back the deadlines on this other work to make space for this. Do I have your okay on that? Some of the psychology here is that, again, comes at more of it from the partnership perspective, but you're also putting the final say back in the hands of the person with more positional power. You as the employee are not just saying, no, won't do this, or not just rolling over, but the final say honors the hierarchy that is in place. And like it or not, even as much as organizations are moving towards flat structures and less hierarchy, it is still the backbone of organizations. We still have positional authority, and we need to be mindful of that as well. So that would be the first approach. I'll pause there.
Great. You've had that conversation, but you didn't just say, take the work on, work all night, burnout, or to your point, and I have seen people really flip out on bosses. because they're overloaded and don't know how to handle that. And that's just not the right way to do it, because there's different ways to get to the same result. So that's brilliant. All right. So that's the trade-off, which I did read in the book and thought was brilliant. What's the second one?
The second one comes from William Ury. He's one of the co-founders of the Harvard Institute on Negotiation. And it's called the positive no. Essentially, you're saying, here's what we can do. So let's say an employee is given a deliverable with a very impossible deadline. It's given to you on Monday. It needs to be done by Friday. The person knows it's actually going to take a month to get this thing done. And so the positive no is, okay, what we can do by Friday is have a first draft of this section. Does that work? And we can have the rest of it by this timeline. Are you on board with that? And the psychology piece here is, many people, when they try to set boundaries at work, they frequently and persistently lead with what they can't do. I'm not able to stay late. I can't accommodate that meeting. This isn't something the team can take on right now. And then unfortunately, that can lead to that label of being difficult. You're not a team player. You're a naysayer. When we just shift that and say, instead of I can't do that meeting, I am available at 2 p.m. and 5 p.m., it doesn't trigger something being taken away from us or something being denied to us. It can psychologically and emotionally feel a lot better for you because you feel like I am being solution focused. I am moving this forward. And the same for the other person on the other end.
Yeah, that one's brilliant. And that one, I think we've always heard it as, I can't do this, but I can do that. But I think the way you reframe it better is to say, to start with, well, we can do this. This will be more challenging, or we will not likely get this done this week, or we can't do this week, but we can do this part. So leading with the can do is really brilliant. What about this question for you? What should HR teach leaders who do great work, but struggle to make their contributions visible to senior stakeholders?
I love this one because I am a big advocate of the idea that good work is not going to speak for itself. As much as I wish the workplace was a meritocracy, it is unfortunately not. And that's becoming all the more true as teams are distributed, people are hybrid, right? Communication can just be very fractured and siloed. And so what I would be coaching this HR leader on is to have your people create their own power map. Now, your power map is a 2x2 grid that looks at different stakeholders, the universe of stakeholders that people need to get in front of in terms of their level of influence, so their decision-making power, their sway, their positional authority, versus their level of interest in a certain initiative or project or area of work, how invested they personally are in that work. And when you map that on a 2x2, you want to focus on the people that are both high influence and high interest. But the utility of this is really helping people map the universe of players, because we tend to think of managing up as this very constrained, oh, I'm managing my relationship with my boss. But you and I both know that it's a lot more complex than that. You need to think about your skip level, your manager's peers. There may be certain project leads or even customers that you have to manage up to, right? People, regulators, people that are external to the organization. And if we have this very narrow view of visibility, we miss out on that. And so this really helps people filter down and prioritize their efforts to think about, okay, who are the stakeholders, the decision makers that are high influence and high interest that I need to keep most closely involved, that I need to be meeting with more often, that I need to be sending more emails to and asking surveys for their input on this project, have more stage gate reviews. It really helps filter that out and helps people focus.
Yeah, it's a great, great tool. And I like the way you're thinking about that from interest and power. I have something called the trust influence compass, which is similar, but you're mapping your trust and your influence of like, how do you feel about each stakeholder? Because a lot of times, especially for HR leaders, HR, whether you're in a COE or an HR business partner, we forget about our peers. Like you said, we forget about the other ancillary folks. We're just thinking about the SVP we report to or that business unit. So I love the way you're thinking about that. And so I do encourage people to really start to map out their network and be much more intentional in how they think about managing these stakeholder relationships. Now, on that same vein, What about a leader who struggles to influence their peers at their boss's level? And it's kind of this upward influence that might actually help them get promoted, right? As we all know, promotions are not one person's decision. They're typically done by a committee or a village, if you will. You've got to convince, if you want to get promoted, everyone who reports to that your boss's level, that you're good enough to come to their level. That is really the game. So how do you manage that upward influence?
In the book, there's a chapter called The Styles Conversation, and I think that plays a huge role in terms of building relationships and trust with people beyond your boss. And in the book, I give this model called the 4 C's, which is based on some pretty well-known psychological research that people's communication styles are broadly based on their level of dominance versus their level of sociability. People listening may know DISC. That's a tool that's based on the same exact research. There's lots out there. Mine is called the 4 C's, but this is almost like you were using the word compass. It's almost that to help you understand, is my boss's peer someone who I would call a commander, a very high dominant type who's lower in sociability, who cares much more about results, speed, outcomes. When you are speaking to or presenting in front of that person, or even sending them an email that they're going to be a part of, you want to be framing what you have done or what you're asking for in language that's going to resonate with them or connect with them, which might be, in their case, competitive advantage versus someone that's what I would call a cheerleader, who's both high dominance and high sociability. That person also likes to move fast. They value speed, but they care more about the people elements. So they're more concerned about optics. How is this going to land with that person? Is this going to increase our status or our reputation in the field? So it's almost like you're shining on different facets of a diamond and flexing to that. You're not completely losing who you are, but you do need to be able to persuade these people. And when your ideas land with them more effectively, they're going to take you more seriously. They're going to want to spend more time with you. They're going to invite you into bigger conversations. And it becomes this great, positive, virtuous cycle.
Yeah. And I love the 3 C's. And I think it's really helpful. And even if it maybe feels a little bit like you're stereotyping a boss, it's okay, because at least you're putting a mindset on of like, how should I approach? Because I think we forget sometimes that we just think we just do our style. And we're not always really thinking about, how do we conform to our boss? How do we make sure that what we say is going to land? And so I think that's a really brilliant technique. Maybe you get it wrong a little bit. Maybe someone's a cheerleader or commander. It's fine, but at least you tried and you learn. And so I think that's a really big one. The other one that I want to ask you about, this one's a tough one, is if a leader needs to give their boss feedback on something that isn't working, how can you help HR to structure that in a way where this lands well?
Let me also say, if an HR leader, you can use managing up as almost a handbook to be teaching people these conversations. The sequencing of them is important. Ideally, you would have been coaching your people to have the alignment conversation, the styles conversation, and all of those are building trust. They are building social capital so that when you get to having a feedback conversation, you've already filled that bank a little bit more. But regardless, a framework I offer in that chapter is called the ABC model. This is a way to help people brain dump and diplomatically approach what they want to share. So A is assumption. What is the assumption you are making about what your boss is doing? They're micromanaging me. They're all over the place. They're playing favorites. B is the actual behavior. So what tells you that they are a micromanager? Well, they are asking to review every single slide before it goes out. And then C is, what is the change you are looking for? What's the request you want to make or ask in this situation? So in the micromanager case, you may say, it would be helpful to have decision-making rights around what I can do more independently versus not, or to understand what has changed, that more oversight is needed with this certain project than the other. When the person has the feedback conversation, you want to coach them on leaving the assumption aside. We're not going to say that part, and focusing on the behavior and the change. And also starting with some sort of a shared goal to show that you and your manager are on the same side of the table versus against each other. You do this, you do that. And a shared goal can be as simple as, I think we could both agree we want to work together as effectively as possible. It could be that general, but now you've created more of an alliance instead of an adversarial situation.
Yeah, I love the ABCs. And I would also think you got to spend some time on the assumption piece, because times we may believe that we are being micromanaged or unfairly treated, but there might be some things that's happening with your leader and why they're doing that. To dig a little bit deeper, to not kind of have the assumption that they are an evil, mean person. Maybe they're being micromanaged, and maybe that's why they're micromanaging you. Maybe there's a different piece of the deadline. So I think some having some empathy to think that through before you go in, because a lot of people get really worked up and get upset about these things and want to give their feedback to their boss on how to be better. And they don't really understand what's actually happening for that leader, because a lot of times the situation is more complex and the situation's causing some of the behaviors we don't want to see from our leaders. They may not even want to be doing that. They may not even be aware of it. So I think going in with this, I want to learn, understand. Tell me a little bit more about what's been going on. I feel like you've been really wanting to micromanage or approve my emails. Like, it seems like that wasn't the case in the past. Has something changed? I think going with some curiosity to open that conversation can get you to a better place as well. But I think that ABC, follow that with that curiosity, I think you'll hit the right note. Two last questions for you, Melody. For HR leaders who want to have more influence, what's your one or two big kind of recommendation power tips besides read the book?
What I would say is, you were talking before when we were discussing styles, how we can get very locked in to our own preferences or our own way of seeing the world. And I think for HR, the way this shows up is we tend to talk about certain terminology or language around the results that we're getting. We're improving retention, where morale is going down and we need to address that. Turnover is higher. We need to address attrition. But we need to think about translating that HR jargon into business outcomes. And so if you are increasing retention, what does that mean in terms of money created, money saved, time created, time saved, reputation increased or protected, for example? Retention, right? We've now eliminated the cost of having to go out and hire new people and the cost of onboarding them or getting a recruitment agency, for example, or a headhunter that we would have to contract with. In terms of morale, what does that translate to in terms of productivity and now freeing up the team to focus on greater sales or client acquisition? So we need to take, and this goes for any sort of sector, but in HR, I see we can get blinders on for our area, and we need to be able to translate it to those business outcomes so it lands with the executives, the C-suite, the people that we're trying to influence. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, instead of overly focusing on problems, coming with recommendations. And this is the classic, come with solutions, not problems. But for HR, unfortunately, even more important, because HR historically has a bad rap. We're the ones that have to break the bad news. We're the ones that are enforcing policies. And so if you come to the table with, this new situation has evolved, here's how we can address it, instead of just saying, this is something we need to address immediately. Okay, what do you recommend? How do we move this forward? If you show ownership and you are the problem solver, then you're going to get much farther than just dumping an issue on an executive's desk.
All right, last question for you, Melody. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's workplace psychology. Why I say this is because the business problems that HR is trying to solve now are largely human behavior problems. It's motivation, buy-in, burnout, it's misalignment in organizations, it's resistance to change. It's not as black and white as just policies and procedures and a compensation plan anymore. It's really understanding, how do people think? How do we navigate people's emotions and get buy-in? How do we navigate their psychology? So I think that's going to be a big trend we will see, and that is going to be necessary.
I love that. Well, if you know workplace psychology, you can manage up. Melody, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Melody for her practical and actionable coaching on how to manage up and have more influence.
As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. So go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. And next week, we'll be joined by DJ Casto, CHRO for Synchrony. He's going to share their journey to become a great place to work and how they're building a culture that embraces flexibility and accountability to deliver for their customers. This was a great conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.